Hi, everybody. My name is Nita Young, and I'm a very fortunate and grateful alcoholic. And it's a rare privilege for me to be here tonight. It's a rare privilege for me to be anywhere in an upright position. See, prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never was. I was one of the people who drank, and I wanted to drink with class, and I wanted to be cool, and I wanted to have some dignity and respect. But you see, alcohol always left me in a prone position. And somebody was always taking me home, or I found myself somewhere else in a prone position. Never upright. I spent a lot of time trying at least that much of dignity to at least walk where I went, not to be carried or dragged. I want you to know that I didn't start out my life like that. As a little kid sitting on the creek bank in Mississippi saying, when I grow up, I want to be dragged out of the party. I want to be carried home on somebody's shoulder. You know, I want to be able to ask somebody, what did we do last night? That just wasn't in there. As I said, I came from a little town in Mississippi. And I was the middle of three kids. I've heard people talk about what a difficult time the older one have, you know, because you're too young, too old to be the baby, and you got to act mature, and you got to sacrifice and let the little one have stuff and all that stuff, you know, the yucky kind of things. And I've heard the younger members of the family talk about what a drag it is to be the baby because they don't ever let you grow up. Well, I'm in the middle, that nobody notice you, you know. So, oh, yeah, Nita, that kind of stuff. Insignificant Nita. I always felt that way. Since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I recognized that I was not insignificant, that I came from a very loving and caring family. They were just all crazy, that's all. My mother and father was divorced when I was very young, and the law of the land said that I had to go live with my mother's side of the family. That was the Bible toting group, you know, that it could rain in the roof and they would still say amen and everything is wonderful. Now, my father's side of the family was the bootleggers and the loud music and the hellraisers, man. And that's where I wanted to be. Because it seemed to me that no matter how much blood was on the floor the night they had the party, it looked like they was having a good time. And that's where I wanted to be. I came from that little town in Mississippi, as I said, and I want to share with you the ratio of how things was mixed up there. The place I came from had 8 taverns, and it was a dry county, 3 churches, Baptist, Methodist, and Presbyterian, and some close members of my family belonged to all 3. You know, when they got mad with the Baptists, 2 or 3 of them went over to the Presbyterian. When they got mad, 4 of them went over to the Methodist, you know. And 1 school. And everybody went to the same school. You know, little kids, big kids, everybody. In one of those, in schools, you know, they taught us to be good citizens and all that stuff. And on Saturday nights at one of the bars or one of the taverns, somebody got shot or cut or killed. And on Sunday morning in one of the 3 churches, they prayed about it. Now, that was the excitement in the town. Ever since I've been yay high, I said to myself, I got to get out of here. With only 250 people in the town, I don't know when my number's coming up, man. I got to get out of here. Ever since I've been big enough to recognize that I was a human being, I always felt different. I always felt outside and alone, and I always felt that I didn't belong to anything and anybody. Since I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I recognized that I'm not alone in that feeling. But growing up, I could have sworn that I was the only human being on the face of the earth who felt like that. And the sad thing is, I didn't know if I could tell anybody. And how would you tell your parents, I don't think I belong to you? Tell me again, am I really yours? Oh, come on, be honest. You can tell me the truth. Did you find me somewhere? You know, and wanting to know, but dare not ask because you really don't want to know. The pain of not knowing is greater than the pain of knowing. So I did a lot of fantasizing as a kid. I lived in my own world and I had my own friends. And you know, I kept them until I got to alcohol snuff. When I was 14, we left that little nothing kind of a place. And we moved to Michigan. And I thought that all my problems would be solved. I thought that now I'm out of this little hick town where all of the Johns are outside, you know, and you have to pump the water and all this crazy stuff. I thought, I'm going to a big city, finally, and it's going to be all right. I didn't know at the time that I was taking me, and it wasn't anything about my surroundings that was out of order. It was the way I thought. So they took this country little kid out of her natural habitat, out of her natural surroundings, and they moved me to the city where they had more than 5 cars in the community. Detroit, Michigan, man. Cars everywhere. Buildings taller than 2 stories. Inside toilets. And I couldn't function. I was always a pretty good student. But when I got to Michigan, I don't know why I thought, but I was just reasonably certain that A and B, or 2 plus 2, didn't mean the same thing in Michigan that it meant in Mississippi. That's really crazy, but that's how I thought. And so consequently, I didn't like school. All of a sudden, I didn't like school. And I want to tell this to somebody. I wanted so badly to tell my mama, baby, when you was issuing out rules for living, I don't know where I was. I missed it. Would you tell me again? I wanted to say, hey, I hurt bad, and I don't know what's hurting me, and I don't know why I feel so outside and alone, but I do. Somebody help me. But who do you tell? Who? Mama, I feel outside and alone. Would you help me? Well, what's the problem, dear? I don't know. What are the symptoms? I don't know. Even to me, that sounded stupid. So I thought, well, you better double up, kid, and buckle down and really get a handle on this thing. Because, you see, even then I knew it was me. I just didn't know what to do about it. And I had never had a drink. And it was weird then. One night at a teenage gathering, my first cousin said to me, you know, what you need is a good shot of something that'll make you feel good. Go on down in the basement, and we got something down there that'll make you feel good. And what they had down there was Wild Irish Rose wine. I walked down, and I didn't say a word. Somebody shoved a cup in my hand. And while I waited for the good feeling to come, I passed out. If I didn't have to talk to you until 9:30, that would be the extent of my life, drinking. Drinking and passing out. Wanting to be cool and swearing this time it's going to be different. Nobody's going to have to take me home. Nobody's going to have to explain to me what I did. Nothing, but each time it was the same. Always somebody carrying me in and then being mad at me the next day by some of my shenanigans. You know. I took to alcohol like a duck takes to water. Because you see, before I passed out, all of a sudden it didn't matter to me that I had 2 left feet. I got up and I danced anyway. And all of a sudden it didn't matter that my tongue got thick and I stammered a lot when the guys came around. With that Wild Irish Rose wine in me, man, I talked up a blue streak. And just before I went out, I knew I had found the secret for life. King alcohol. I mentally kicked myself for, why haven't you tried this sooner? Because all of a sudden I felt okay, and you looked okay, and the world was a beautiful place to live. And so for the next 11 years, I pursued booze and everything it had to offer me just for that moment, just for that feeling like I'm okay, and the world is okay. But you know, I want to share something with you. No matter how much I drank from that day on, that feeling of utopia, that everything was wonderful, I never got it again. I always tried to get it, but somehow overshot my goal there. And while I was waiting for it, I was already drunk. And I couldn't figure out what happened to it. Why can't I find it? But I never got it again. But it was so wonderful, it kept me going back day after day because I was an everyday drinker. And after a few weeks of drinking every day, all of a sudden Detroit, Michigan got too small for this kid, I tell you. And I thought to myself, I need to get the hell out of here. I need to go somewhere and claim my fame and fortune. And I don't know what I thought I was going to do to claim it. You know, I sing well with the choir as long as there's somebody to hold me up, right? I can't dance and I can't sing, you know, all that stuff. But somehow I imagined my name on a marquee somewhere. And all those people who mistreated me all my life was going to be real sorry. And I was going to show them how good-hearted a person I was. I was going to send them a pension every month to show them that, well, there was no hard feelings. Upon graduation from high school, I came to Los Angeles. And I was sure that this time it was going to be different, that things was going to be all right. Nobody up to that moment, nobody in my family had ever gone to college. I want you to understand that my family, my parents, are very honest, good people. They just didn't place very much emphasis on education. They figured if you manage to get through high school, go find yourself a job, I don't care what it is, and be a good citizen. Well, that was not my forte. I just couldn't imagine myself trying to do hard labor of no kind. And I figured if I could slough off, if I went to college, you know, that would buy me a little time. But you see, I was drinking every day. And when I drank by now, I yelled a lot. And I hollered. And I was inappropriate, you know. And a few times I was calling in, and the dean talked to me about this. And she wanted me to tell her why I was yelling. I couldn't tell her why I was yelling. She said, I don't know why I'm yelling. When I drink wine, I yell. It's simple as that. You know? Obviously something to hurt, but I don't know what it is. I just yell. I knew that eventually I was going to get kicked out of school for the shenanigans. So being a good thinking, smart alcoholic, I thought, maybe I ought to do something better than go to school anyway because I'm bored. I certainly know more than the instructors anyway. And I need to do something even better than that so the family wouldn't say, see, I told you, you should have gone and find yourself a job. So what I decided to do was join the Army. Woo! Oh, man. Here's a person who had never followed instructions from anybody. Never. And I don't know what made me think that I would fit in the Army. But I went all the way there to Fort McClellan, Alabama. I envisioned myself the first woman general. And man, as that plane soared a little bit, shit, I was the first woman president. You know. When I got off the plane, I realized I was just a buck private. Sergeant met me at the airport, did some yelling and screaming, made me throw out my gum and called me dumb and stupid, and I thought, nobody talked to me this way. At about 5 weeks of basic training and I'm getting yelled and screamed at and called dumb and stupid every day, I thought, bullshit. I don't have to take this from nobody. And I told her so too. Needless to say, that didn't go over well. I even went so far as to tell her that I was ready to leave. And I didn't have to take that from anybody. You know, I can go home. And she told me that I had signed my name and I had taken an oath to stay in service for 2 years. And I realized I did that, but anything could be broken. Bullshit, it's time for me to leave. Nobody was impressed. I want to tell you people in here who's young enough to still can be able to go and join the military. If you get there, you ain't gonna like it. And people talk bad to you and stuff. And you don't like that. There's a guaranteed, surefire way out. Try pushing drugs on a military base. How I got into that little enterprise and thing is just ridiculous within itself. I had never even seen drugs in my life. And I was at a bar getting drunk in town one night. And these guys were talking at the next table. They weren't even talking to me. And they was talking about they would have a gold mine if they had somebody on post to deal for them. And I dashed right over and said, I'm it. I know everything you need me to know, I'm it. They had to be really crazy too because they believed me. The only problem with that is they gave me the stuff with no front money or nothing. They gave it to me and now I'm supposed to meet them at a set place in town every Friday afternoon and settle up, right? But I'm an alcoholic. And I like for all my friends to be happy. The first Friday I had to report to town to settle up, I had nothing. Money and nothing else, because we parted it up, shit. I didn't use drugs. But my friends did, and they just turned on. You don't need money, kids, you got me. And needless to say, the folks in town was mad. And that was one of the times I was really grateful that I was in the service so they couldn't get me. It wasn't too long after that that they began to tell me that my kind wasn't necessarily wanted in the military. And I thought, as good a soldier as I've been, they have the nerve to say they don't want me. And I thought, I'll show them. And as I'm leaving the Pentagon, where I was stationed, on my way to New York City, with my nose pressed against a Greyhound bus window, tears streaming down my face because I felt like they had used me. I'm saying to myself, I'll show them. I show them that they really, truly abused a good soldier. They'll never find anybody like me. I stayed in New York for 11 months. And I didn't breathe a sober breath the whole time I was there, and I didn't work either, I want you to know. My soul looked back and wondered today how I got over, because I don't know. I really, truly don't know. I know I met an awful lot of wonderful people who seemed to, their maternal or paternal instinct came out and they sort of looked after me. Today I recognize that that was God doing his work because I certainly couldn't take care of myself. And he put a lot of good people in my life. You know, it's really great when you can live in New York City for 11 months and don't pay rent. None. You know, and I lied to them, my landlord, all the time. I'm going to go to church with you. I'm looking for a job. Never did any of those things. But she let me stay there for a year. Like everything else that happened in my life, I found a way to screw that up. And one morning, about 3 o'clock, somebody put a 45 at my head. And they said, New York City has 8 million people and you're not one of them. Get out of here. That was the first thing I ever believed in my life. And I tried to figure out, where am I going to go? Typical. I called my mother and I told her a lie. I said, I got a real great job, but I'm going to walk away and leave it. Because I miss you so much. Now here is a kid who never obeyed her mother ever. Here's a kid who thought my mother, I always thought my mother was absolutely insane. And I laid that line of shit on her. Even today, I don't know whether she believed or that she just loved me so much that she said, hell with it, come home. I went back to Michigan and I stayed another 11 months and I didn't do anything but mooch off of her. And finally, she said to me, I'm sick of you. Get out. And on my way back to Los Angeles, sitting on the Greyhound bus, my face pressed against the window. How could my mother, own mother, do this to me? As good a kid as I am, how could she do this to me? I'll show her. When I got to Los Angeles, I was in Los Angeles 3 months before I recognized I was there because I was stoned when I got there. And it took me about 3 months to go through the money. And then the landlady of the hotel, the hotel manager was screaming and banging on the door every day talking about I owed some money. There's nothing worse in the world than somebody's hounding us for money when we don't have any, especially when we got a hangover. So I did what all good alcoholics do. I went to the nearest watering hole and sat there and tried to ponder over my problems, how I was going to handle the situation. And the answer to my problem walked in the door. All 6 feet, 4 inch, 220 pounds came right on in. Took 2 months, but there was some pursuing going on both sides, and he became my husband. The only problem with that was this man was not an alcoholic. He totally deceived me. Because of that 2 months of pursuing, we parted all the time. And seemingly to me, the moment we got married, he began to talk stuff about, when are you going to cook? How come the house ain't clean? I need clean shirts. I'm sick of walking in here stepping over drunks because I brought all my friends with me wherever we went. And I thought to myself, shit. He want a maid. If he did, he should have married one. I'm not a maid. And I'm not going to do any of these things he want me to do. He gave me a choice. To straighten up my act and get rid of my drunken friends, or he was gone. Now, he put this on me when I was 3 shades to the wind gone, right? And nobody tells me what to do when I'm drunk. And I don't care if you are my meal ticket. I showed him, I bet you. I told him, get out, who needs you? You know, that was almost 24 years ago. And to my knowledge, he has not returned. Not even for a visit. Not even called to say hello. Nothing. And you see, this man loved me with a wild present, too. I was in family way. Now, I knew where he was. I knew he was at his brother's house. But I want to share with you how sick I had become. I knew all I had to do was call and say something. But the idea, because people had begun to talk to me now about drinking, now I had a grand excuse to drink. This man left me in this terrible condition. You would drink too. When my first daughter was born, I've heard women talk about the bittersweet magic of motherhood and how they hold the kid in their arms for the first time and they get all warm and emotional and stuff, and tears sort of fall of joy and happiness and peace and shit. Real. God, what have you done? I don't know anything about a kid. What do you give me this kid for? What can I do with it? You know. And I remember standing over my kid's crib in a drunken stupor, screaming at her, shut up. This is just as new to me as it is to you. Shut up. I don't know what to do for you. You're not hungry, and I don't know what else to do for you. Your diapers have changed. Just shut up. A lot of mornings, I'd wake up, and I'd open my eyes, and the first thought would hit me was the kid. And inside my mind, I wish she would be dead. If not dead, be gone. I wasn't going to hurt her. Just magically, maybe she would just die. Or maybe the fairy godmother or something would, you see, I told you I lived in a lot of fantasy world. Just somebody would just take her and she'd be gone. And I wouldn't have this responsibility anymore because I just couldn't cut it. My sister's a mother of four, and she seemed to me that she knows all about babies. Like, she knew the hungry cry from a wet cry, from just bullshit cry to something serious cry. And I couldn't differentiate between all that stuff. I didn't know that motherhood, like everything else, is a learned procedure. I didn't know that when she had her first kid, she didn't know either. And I figured that if I didn't know it, I didn't need to know it, and it wasn't worth knowing, and goodbye, kid. Well, I want to tell you something. She didn't die, and she didn't leave. She's still there to haunt me today. By now, I'm drinking every single day, and weird things are happening to me. Weirder things are happening to me. Real scary things. Like it's taken me almost an hour to cross the street at a light now. Because I was too scared to cross. When the light would turn green, I didn't think I'd have enough time before it turned red again to cross, so I'd stand there. And people kept passing and looking. Are you going to cross? Yeah, when the light changed. And I'd just stand there. And somebody would help me across. By now, my toilet and tub had begun to talk to me. You laugh, you probably had one like that too. My toilet would say stuff like, if you sit on me tonight, kid, down, 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 you go. My tub would say, ain't no sense in putting no good smelling stuff in me, because you going down the drain, baby. In my moments of clarity, I know animated objects ain't supposed to talk. But that didn't excuse the fact that mine was talking. So who are you going to tell it to? Rashawn, tell your best friend, you know my tub and toilet is talking. No way. See, I forgot to tell you guys that in my hometown there was a lady named Miss Bell. And periodically, they would come and take Miss Bell away to the mental institution. And about maybe once a month, they'd take her away. And when she'd get back home, she'd come to church that Sunday morning, and she'd sit a while and listen to Reverend Smith talk. Then she'd get up, slap hell out of him, and take over the pulpit and talk. And everybody was too scared to make her sit down and do something with her, right? So she just had the audience. The damnedest thing is, everything she talked about, I understood exactly what she was saying. And so years later, as an adult, when my toilet and tub is talking to me, I know I can't tell nobody because they'll take me away like they did Miss Bell. I didn't realize that they took her away, not because of what she said, but with the things that she did, you know. Maybe one day I'll look in one of these rooms like this and maybe she'd be sitting here, you know. I got a sneak suspicion that was the problem. Anyway, by now my family's trying to get rid of me. They'll give me to anybody who want me. No questions asked. Just find a way to get rid of this one. You know, when you introduce your daughter or your niece or your cousin to a gentleman, you would like to know, what does he do? Nobody was asking that anymore, you know. And they'd introduce me to guys, and my mouth was bad. And the guys take one look now because I didn't get in the tub like I should no more because it was talking. And so I stayed dirty a lot. And the guys would take one look, and they'd go away. I didn't care. But my family was determined, man, that they was going to find me somebody so they could get me out of the hair. The last person that they recruited for me was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how I got to you. This man had found the program in the penitentiary. You see, as I said, by now they really wasn't particular. And they told him about me, and they told him what a wonderful person I was, but she drinks a little bit too much sometimes. Lied, that's what they did. And on September the 16th, 1967, this man came a-calling. I like to say that I made an incredible impression on him. And in the real sense, I did. This man had been on the streets about 4 weeks from the penitentiary, so he sort of was like, for female companionship. Well, he took one look at me and he recognized that his sex problem was secondary. And he told me, lady, you need to go with me now. You won't live to see in the morning. I didn't know I was that bad off. I know I was bad, but I didn't think I was that bad off. And he began to talk to me. And for the second time in my life, I don't know why it was, but I believed what he said. He said to me, I used to drink like you. But I found a way today that I don't have to. And I know a place that if you'd be willing to go with me, there's a good chance that you won't have to either. And I thought, oh yeah? Shit. But being a diplomatic person, I said to him, certainly in my drunken voice, I'll be happy to go with you sometime. He said, get dressed, we going now. Made me mad in hell because I was dressed. I had on everything I had to wear. And I said, no, I'll go with you tomorrow. And then I became very angry and agitated with this person. And I thought, watch him. He's probably up to no good. Keep your eye on him. He might be trying to take advantage of you. And when I woke up 2 hours later, or 3 hours, however long it was, he was trying to feed me some honey and water, some nonsense, and I'm throwing it, kicking it out of his hand and all this stuff. And in my mind, I'm saying, you keep your eye on this guy. He's just waiting till you go to sleep. And when I came around again, he was reading out of a big blue book. That's right, kid, keep your eye on this clown. When I woke up again, it was the next day, and he said, we'd better go. You need AA. And the most magnificent thing anybody has ever said to me, even in a drunken stupor, he said to me, AA needs you. And I wanted so badly to be needed, and I never thought I could be, that I dashed out to see you in a drunken stupor, willing to give you whatever it was I had. And God bless you. It didn't seem to matter to you that I hadn't had a bath in a long, long time, and that I shook and I was scared, and that I felt so outside and alone. But you put your loving arms around me and you held me, and you said, Nita, welcome aboard. God damn, nobody said that to me, ever. Certainly not the way you did. The third thing in my life I believed. I believed you that night when you said I never had to drink again as long as I live if I didn't want to. And this coming September, it'll be 20 years. I want to share with you that many, many things have come and gone in these past years. But the very basic things that you shared with me at my first meeting, that I never had to drink again as long as I live if I didn't want to. And that if I needed to, you'd go to hell with me. But if I drink, I could go to hell by myself. There's been many, many times in my life that that's all I've had. What's that? I don't have to drink today, no matter what. And they're with me as long as I don't. And a lot of days that has carried me. But after a while, you introduced me to a God of my own understanding. Not the kind that Miss Bill and Reverend Smith had a confrontation over long years ago. But a loving God who understood and understands Nita, the woman, the alcoholic. And who's just waiting in the wings to help. And I thought to myself, how could it all be so simple? Why is it that I've missed this all along? And one of the reasons was because I never wanted to share. I never wanted to acknowledge to anybody that I needed help. I never wanted to let you or God or anybody else know how I felt inside. Because I was reasonably certain that if you knew, you wouldn't want me. And I was convinced that God didn't want me. And I come to a smoke-filled room like this, and you tell me, not so, kid. We want you. God wants you. And we're going to teach you how to want yourself. I made just about every mistake that can be made in this program and still remain sober because, you see, I had that thing inside me that I'll do it my way. But I was sneaky with it, too. I do just a little bit my way, and if it hurt, run back and do it yours. Ago, I moved from Los Angeles to San Diego, and I didn't know that I was going to move here. When I came here, I came just to visit. And while I was here, I got seriously ill. And it took about 8 months to recover. And I realized that I don't have anything to go back to Los Angeles for. Now, I want you to know that I didn't accept this willingly and beautifully like I'm talking about it tonight. Kicking and screaming every step of the way. My whole life was going down the goddamn drain. He, God, what are you doing putting me in this godforsaken place like San Diego? America's finest city, right? You see how crazy I am? I would have traded it all in for smog, crowded freeways, long lines at the bank, robberies on every corner. You know, all of it. But you know, it's an amazing thing when God has something for you to do. And you come and listen, because I ain't going to be the spiritual always when you see me again. When God has something for you to do, you can run, but you cannot hide. You can rebel and you can refuse, but it ain't going to go away. What he has for me to do, and every morning I wake up wondering, is he crazy? He wanted me to work in detox. I thought, hey, wait a minute, God. I'm a good person. Why do you do this to me? You took away my car. You took away my job I've had for years. You took away my house, everything, and you left me in this place, and you tell me to go work in detox? Drunk people all day long, you tell me to go work in detox? You know, seriously, today I know why, and I thank him for every drunk person who walked in the door. I thank him just for the privilege to be obedient, although I fought it. I'm saying this because if you knew, and you don't like nothing I said, and I know you don't like nothing the sponsor said, so don't try to push at me. I know you don't. You know, because we try to pretend to our sponsors that we're so into it. We read or we heard something in a meeting that somebody said, and we dash and tell our sponsor, bam, because we're trying to impress rather than express. And we want to be just well when we talk to our sponsors so they won't think we're so crazy. I got a secret for you. They know. They know. And the reason that they know is because they've been there too. So I guess I'm just saying to you that if you can muster up enough honesty to just get real, no matter how crazy it is, no matter how mixed up it is, no matter how twisted the words come out, it's not what you say physically anyway. What's said from the heart reaches the heart. If you're sick and tired of what you have, and if you want a brand new way to live, the most exciting adventure that you could ever imagine. Not even in your wildest drunken dreams can you imagine what sobriety is like. It's all about living, learning, relearning, surrendering, just loving God because he is. Not because I want nothing today, just loving him because he is. Just loving my brothers and sisters because they are. And knowing in return that I'll be loved too, just because I'm me. Thank you. May God bless you.